At a recent speaking gig, my handler asked me to hold out my wrist. When I did, she flicked a reflective neon slap bracelet on my outstretched arm. My inner child of the 90s thought that was pretty damn cool. She told me, "This is just in case security stops you later," as she escorted me to the backstage area. That bracelet indicated to anyone on the lookout that yes, I belong here. I have access to this space. Now, who am I that I get access to this space? Why is my access necessary? And how is that access supported by the space, the people, and the policies of the space? I get access because I'm a speaker. My access is necessary because that's where I put my stuff, center my thoughts, and eat the dinner that's been provided for me. My access is ensured by that very cool slap bracelet. I can move in and out of the space freely because I've been marked in a way people can easily take notice of. The backstage pass is a classic form of access control. It exists for very good reasons. If anyone and everyone could move freely backstage, performances would get interrupted, performers might get stressed out, and chaos would ensue. Now, who gets granted that backstage pass or very cool neon slap bracelet is pretty straightforward. There's a list of people who qualify based on their relationship to the performance or performers, and everyone else doesn't qualify. And sure, sometimes you could buy your way to a backstage pass too. When it comes to backstage accessibility at a concert or a conference, you're either on the list or you're not. Either you qualify or you don't. But few social spaces are so clear-cut when it comes to access. Yet, the question of access is embedded in every social space. Anywhere there is two or more people, there are implied questions and answers about who belongs and who doesn't. And this is true online as well as offline. Typically, the question of access online is considered in technical terms. How does this website need to be designed? What alt text is appropriate for this image? Are captions available for this video? And obviously, knowing the technical aspects of accessibility is important. But if accessibility stops at the technical requirements, we forget that there are people on the other side of those checklists and manuals. We forget that even the most rigorous checklist doesn't account for everyone. We forget to ask critical questions that seem obvious when it comes to a backstage pass, but are readily dismissed when it comes to most other social spaces. I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show that rethinks work, business, and leadership for the 21st century economy. This is the third episode in my five-part series, Decoding Empathy. In the first installment, I examined what empathy actually is and how we've come to think of it as a necessary skill for work, despite our inability to define it. In the second installment, I talked with Chloe Wangwu about recognition, visibility, and brand strategy. In that episode, I mentioned disability studies scholar Tanya Tichkovsky. Today, we'll dig deeper into Tichkovsky's work, including what she calls a politics of wonder, and we'll learn from accessibility educator Aaron Perkins. Accessibility doesn't arise from a checklist of technical requirements or types of people. Accessibility is the result of a complex form of perception, argues Tanya Tichkovsky in her book, The Question of Access. Now, I'd call that complex form of perception empathy. Not only knowing, but actively perceiving the world as full of people who are not you and may not have the same access to or experience of social spaces that you do.
Growing up, I was very fortunate to have parents that really advocated for me. I always had everything provided to me, access-wise, interpreters, captioning, all of that stuff.
That's Erin Perkins. She's the founder of Mably Q, an accessibility education firm that helps small business owners build more inclusive and accessible products and services. And Erin is deafblind.
I have been a graphic designer for 20 plus years. This was something that I've done since high school. I love it. I'm very fortunate to have to go to school for it and work in a graphic design field. So I really loved it. But I got laid off in 2017 and I finished working with them in January 2018.
After she was laid off, Erin decided to give freelancing a go. In the process, she realized that there were all sorts of people a new business owner could learn from online.
This is where things got really interesting because I started seeing in small business world, you could really learn from other people. And I was like, this is awesome. And then I would start trying to learn from them. I was like, oh, none of their videos are captioned. So I would reach out to them and I'm like, look, I really love your stuff, but it's not captioned. I've invested my money into this, and yet I can't get the same experience as the person that's hearing.
Erin had purchased a backstage pass, but still wasn't able to access the backstage.
And they're like, well, we don't know how to do that. And I was like, oh.
Erin figured that if it was just a knowledge issue, she could learn and then pass on that knowledge to those who needed it.
And I think that's where I was like, oh, well, let me figure it out. I started trying to figure it out, and I realized it was actually pretty complicated. And I was like, if I have trouble understanding this, how can I expect any other small business owner to understand this? So that's how I fell into doing accessibility education, because I wanted it to make it easy for small business owners, because I understood the pain and the growth that you would go through. And if I can make it one thing in their business easier for them, this would be it.
Now, this strikes me as an incredibly generous response to being unrecognized. I asked Erin if she ever responded to a lack of access with, let's say, stronger feelings.
For sure. It was definitely a lot of frustration and just annoying. It was almost like, oh my God, we are in 2020 something years. Have you never met a disabled person before? If you haven't, that's a problem. Your world is very close. So it would definitely be frustration and annoyance. Anger definitely came into the picture, especially more with the bigger company, because it was you have the money. You obviously just don't give a fuck. But with small businesses, especially if I knew the person, that person was just the one person doing everything themselves, I would be I would have a lot more empathy towards them, because I was like, I get it. Can we work together to figure this out? And a lot of times they would come back to me and be like, yeah, look, can we please figure it out? But then there will also be other companies where they were just like, I don't care.
Erin's incredulous question, have you never met a disabled person before, struck me as important. I'd venture to guess that everyone has met a disabled person, but that doesn't mean that they recognize the person they met as disabled.
So I would say one of the biggest things is a lot of us were raised, especially the millennial, we were raised with the vision, the visibility that a person with a disability is in a wheelchair. And that's literally the global icon for person with a disability is in a wheelchair. We have that blue circle with the person in a wheelchair. That's just how it's always been. So when I got older in my late 20s and 30s and people would meet me, they're like, oh, I had no idea you were deaf. Well, I understand it's not visible and I speak. So that tends to be something that I feel like, but you don't look deaf. I'm like, how does the deaf person supposed to look? And then now that I say that I'm deafblind, my identity for deafblind was something that I took on last year. And people are like, but you don't look deafblind. I'm like, I understand that. Not all disabilities are visible. So it's really explaining to people that you cannot make the assumption based by judging a person by the way they look. It's just simple as that. Like, a lot of people, you would not know, because we meet a lot of people virtually now, you would not know if they had a disability unless they, like, explicitly told you. Somebody could have, like, an amputated leg, and you would never know because you're looking at them on the screen, or you're just, like, listening to them on a podcast. Like, you just would not know. So when somebody tells you they have a disability, you need to take that and be like, oh, okay, and learn from it.
That's why we need what Tanya Tichkoski calls a politics of wonder. She writes, it is possible to nurture a desire to wonder about the everyday act of perceiving disability. In the process, we start to question our assumptions about what's quote-unquote normal and who is quote-unquote naturally excludable. Cultivating a politics of wonder might sound poetic, but its implications are radical and material. If your body and cultural markers resemble the mythical norm, there are probably a lot of forms of access that you take for granted. Further, you probably assume that others have a similar level of access to yours, unless there's ample evidence to the contrary, such as the presence of a wheelchair. Choosing to wonder calls all that into question. You wonder, as Tichkoski puts it, who is together with whom, how, where, when, and why. You might even start to wonder how your access to social spaces varies. Choosing to wonder about the nature of access and what it means changes everything. One of the things I often wonder about is how much more someone has to work, how much more effort they have to expend to have access to a space or relationship. To play off Chloe Wanglu's terminology from the last episode, what is the inaccessibility tax that people pay to be here?
Oh my gosh, like, as a deaf person, I'm always doing more work than any other hearing able human being. I don't like to wear my hearing aid out in public much anymore, because I'm like, the world's noisy. Who wants to hear all of this stuff? So somebody would like start talking to me, and I'd be like, I'm deaf. Can't understand you, but I will not speak it, because the minute I speak, they'll be like, oh, she can lip read. No, that's not the case. And so it's literally me having to do that education right from the moment I met them. But I will tell you a story. I was in Austin, Texas just a few weeks ago, and there's a deaf community there. It's a pretty big deaf community. But, like, there were days that I would just, like, go out with my friend and my husband, not wear my hearing aid, and I would order my food, and then the person behind the register would be, like, asking me a question, and I'd be like, oh, I'm deaf. And they don't even flinch. And that was, like, the most amazing part. They just quickly adapted. And they didn't put that burden back on me. They were like, oh, and then you've got like a piece of paper, wrote it down, tested it. Like, and that happened often throughout my trip in Austin. I was like, oh, this is how it feels. The burden's not placed on me.
The burden's not placed on me. That's just it. Choosing to wonder, to question the who, what, why, and how of how we come together helps to balance the burden. Instead of a lucky few quote-unquote normal folks floating through life, everyone can pitch in and do their part to make our social spaces as accessible and inclusive as possible. If you're a small business owner or independent worker who wants to choose Wonder and share the workload, what do you do?
Well, one thing I would tell people is get out of your own bubble. It is so easy to stay inside your own bubble. I get it, it's your comfort zone. But as a small business owner, you're usually building and creating something that you wanted. So I understand that. But at that point, you've created it. But now you got to think, what about people that are not like me? Most of your audience are not going to tell you they have a disability, because usually they don't want it as part of the story. Mine happened to be part of my story. It's like how I grew up, how I was raised. I fought against wanting it to be part of my story. And then I was like, damn it. If I was not born this way, I would not be here in this path. I would be on a completely different path. Who knows where I would be. So when I meet these people, it's just by showing them, you know, the different ways to apply accessibility into your business without it costing you a lot of money, and creating that experience for anybody who would want to experience your business. So, like, I often tell them, start with your social media, because that's how a lot of people tend to find you. So if you make your social media bubble comfortable, like by adding captions, by doing hashtags in camel case, by doing little things like that, it's going to be like, oh, I'm drawn to this person. Like, I would like to work for this person. And then you move on to the website, and then you get to know them through there. So it's really building all those little pieces in. It's going to make a difference for a lot of people.
Checklist accessibility isn't really accessibility at all. But that doesn't mean the items on the checklist aren't important. They are. And what's more, those checklist items, alt text, camel case hashtags, captions, transcripts, can be tools for expanding our perception and inspiring wonder. The same goes for other tools like introducing yourself with your pronouns or acknowledging the land and its people. These are tools that remind us to wonder about who is gathered together and who is excluded. They're tools that remind us to practice open-minded empathy.
So the way I practice empathy is really more of not necessarily trying to understand how that or relate to how that person feels, because there's going to be a point where I'm never going to like get that feeling like I totally get it 100%, because that's just not true. It's like I will never understand a person of color feeling, what they go through, what journey they go through, and that's okay. And as long as I am open to learning what they teach me, I feel like we find that balance within each other. And I think that has always been really important. And I've also learned this when me and my friends were going through, like, you know, up and down turmoil. And one of the things was I've learned that sometimes we hate it when the other person's like, oh, I totally understand how you feel. And you're just like, no, you don't. And I had to break through. From that, I had to break that train of thought of like, no, you cannot say, I totally understand how you feel. You can probably pick a scenario and say, this doesn't compare to your situation, but this is something that I've been through. I don't know if this will help you. So it's that kind of thing. And I feel like that has helped a lot of people be like, okay, so I won't ever understand how you feel or what your experience is, but you can at least make their experience with you even 1% better. And that's what matters.
Empathy requires curiosity. It requires wonder. It requires recognizing all of the different ways people feel, experience, and relate to the world. And if your circle of recognition shuts down your curiosity and wonder instead of sparking it, it's time to expand that circle.
It's tricky because you are almost more likely to have your own circle of friends that are very similar to you. Like, I admit it, like, my core group of friends are mostly white females that are also deaf. But it's interesting because every single one of us have an extremely different background in terms of how we were raised and what our families are like. So that's a little fascinating. But we all really connect with each other because, one, we're deaf. And so we can, like, relate to that. And, yeah, we want that communication to be effortless. And that was really important to us. But in the business world, I know it can be challenging to be like, all right, I want to find and make friends with all kinds of people. You're not going to be friends with everyone. You're not going to be able to talk to everyone. But the biggest thing you can do is intentionally stick out or have people share who you should follow on Instagram, who you should connect with. Continuously trying to ask for introduction. I aggressively be like, hey, I really want to meet this person. And I get somebody I know, introduce me to that person, and then they introduce me. And we're constantly trying to build out that network. My network is constantly growing because of the desire I have to meet as many people as possible and get to know as many people as possible. But there are other businesses that are like, they just want to stay in their little bubble and say, so it's just like trying to encourage them, like, step out, promise you, people don't bite. We're all good. We all want the same thing. And you're going to make mistakes. You are 100%. I've made so many mistakes. I put my foot in my mouth and I'm just like, ooh, did not mean to do that. So it's one of those things that we all have to just be like willing to admit that you made mistakes, move on, learn from it, grow from it. And your world will get that much better. This is my sign off in all my emails, is progress, not perfection. And I think that is something that when I email a new person and they see that, they're like, whew, you just, like, lifted this whole weight off my shoulder. And I'm like, yeah, like, I don't expect you to be perfect. I'm not perfect. I'm by far from perfect. Nor do I ever want to be perfect. Like, that's not the illusion I want to set. And I think that has been a massive problem with social media in general. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these small businesses. When I first stepped in, I was like, oh my God. Look at all these, like, curated Instagram feeds. Look at all these really fancy websites, and they're so, like, neat. But then when you peel those layers back, you realize they weren't perfect. They're far from perfect. And I think that's what we all need to realize, is that we're not perfect people, and it's really all about progress.
I think empathy is really all about progress, too. Empathy isn't something you have or you don't. It's a complex form of perception, one that we can expand, deepen, and hone. When Erin says she isn't perfect and that it's progress, not perfection, that matters, she reminds us that we all have something to learn about access. Tanya Tichkovsky refers to this as our half and half nature. She writes, we are all, in some sense, half and half, a part of and apart from where we find ourselves. Half in the circle of recognition and half out of the circle of recognition. And so part of the lesson I take from my conversation with Erin, as well as from Tichkovsky's work, is that we need to cultivate self-empathy, too. Maybe self-empathy sounds like an oxymoron, but self-empathy acknowledges that there are parts of ourselves that we treat as other, that we don't fully understand, that we don't have full access to. Self-empathy recognizes that there are parts of ourselves we deny or disparage simply because they remind us of our distance from the mythical norm. I don't know anyone who hasn't molded themselves to fit a little more comfortably into the containers that school, work, family, and community have provided for us. There are parts of ourselves we hide, parts we disown, parts we fail to explore. Society teaches us not to wonder about our own identities and the way those identities make it harder to access certain spaces. We learn to perceive our differences as deficits rather than facts that deserve accommodation. A couple of years ago, I read a paper by sociologist Catherine Tan on the self-narrative impact of late autism diagnosis. In this paper, she coins the term biographical illumination. And I've been obsessed with this term ever since. Biographical illumination is the process by which a diagnosis like autism reshapes one's self-narrative from "what the hell is wrong with me?" to "wow, it all makes sense now." Before biographical illumination, many spend precious time and energy on camouflaging our personal distress on top of the inaccessibility taxes we pay to fit in. Biographical illumination acts, in some ways, as a permission slip for coming out, to stop trying to pass as quote-unquote normal and recognize how we're just normally ourselves. In a 2001 paper, Tichkovsky reflects on the process of coming out disabled. She remarks, quote, "So compelling is such passing that one does not only come out to others, but one must come out from under the seductive power of an unquestioned sense of normalcy. Come out for one's self." As I think on my own biographical illumination, the challenge from Aaron to expand our circles of recognition, and Tichkovsky's idea of coming out for ourselves, I can't help but wonder how many more people than we can realize bear the burden of ignoring or denying their challenges with access and belonging. I wonder whether coming out for ourselves might be part of a move toward radical accessibility and abundant accommodation. Practicing curious, wonder-filled empathy can and should lead to practicing curious, wonder-filled self-empathy. Wondering about others encourages us to wonder about ourselves. Wondering about how others access social spaces can make us wonder about how we access social spaces. Taking on some of the workload of access for others reminds us that others can lend us a helping hand too. When we see others for who they are on their own terms, we have more capacity for seeing ourselves on our own terms as well. The next time you're designing an event, gathering a group of friends together, or posting to social media, remember that accessibility isn't a checklist. It's not a set of answers. It's a question. Who is together with whom, how, where, when, and why? Ask yourself the questions and let yourself wonder. Huge thanks to Erin Perkins for sharing her time, experience, and expertise with me. To learn more about Erin, book your own accessibility audit, or join her Successible community, go to MabelyQ.com. That's MabelyQ.com. My work on subjects like empathy, the self-help industry, and time is possible only because of listeners and readers who chip in as premium subscribers. If you enjoy What Works and you want to see this kind of thinking continue, please consider upgrading if you have the means. For just $7 per month, you get access to my premium columns, live quarterly workshops, and discussion threads. Go to whatworks.fyi to upgrade. That's whatworks.fyi. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.